everybody. It's Dr. Amy Myers. Welcome back to the Myers Way podcast. Today we have an exciting guest, Jennifer Fugo, who is the founder of Gluten Free School, which is a website dedicated to teaching gluten-sensitive individuals common sense, simple and powerful steps to getting healthy. She's a certified health coach and was named the Gluten Free Guru by Philadelphia Magazine. She also has a popular gluten-free sugar cleanse to teach gluten-free folks how to experience positive physical changes through common sense sugar reduction. Jennifer is also an expert that has been contributing to Yahoo News, eHow, CNN, and Philadelphia Magazine. So welcome, Jennifer. We're very excited to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me, Dr. Amy. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to come and share what I know with your audience.
Well, we met kind of through random sources, but I have helped you out with one of your courses, sort of sharing my knowledge, and I'm excited to have you here sharing your knowledge because all you do is focus on gluten-free, and I know you've had a personal experience with gluten, so we'll be excited to hear about that. And I always feel like when somebody's had a personal experience, it really, you know, helps others out there because we really kind of hone in on it and, you know, find our passion and learn everything that we can about it. So I know that you know tons about gluten-free, and I'm excited to share all of your information with the Myers Way community out there.
Awesome. Thank you. So I just want to say, too, that I think one of the things about living gluten-free that I think scares people from the beginning is how much of a learning curve there is. And unfortunately, there's such a huge amount of people that aren't compliant with the diet. And one thing that I appreciate you for is you said in one of your podcasts, you're like, I am living this lifestyle. I am living by example to all of my clients and doing what I need to do to make sure that I stay gluten-free as much as possible. And I think that's one of the most important things that we can provide for our clients, for your patients, for everyone out there, because unfortunately the web is filled with blogs and other sort of, I would say they're very not the greatest sources to find your information from. And you know, I want to talk, I hope we can get in a little bit today about some of the problems with the gluten-free diet that people don't really see as a problem, but actually are. And I think that those, a lot of the typical gluten-free blogs out there really do typify that problem.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. It's funny you say that because today, actually, I somehow, you know how you're on the internet and you get on one thing and it leads you to another. And I got led to this blog and it was tips for traveling. I was like, oh, this might be helpful. You know, I'm traveling soon. I'm going to India and I already have my suitcase half packed with food. But so I'm reading it and it says, you know, after all, it's your vacation. Go ahead. If you feel like you need to indulge, you can get back on track when you get home. And I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, no, like you cannot say that to people. When you genuinely have a gluten sensitivity, these effects of eating gluten can be shown in your inflammatory markers in your body for up to 3 to 6 months and the damage to your gut. So I really feel like we're on the same page about that. And there is a lot of misinformation. And then also, as you know, there's sort of the step, you know, going gluten-free, and then a lot of people, and we'll get into that, kind of just replace their sort of standard American diet with a gluten-free standard American diet, which, you know, isn't really the healthiest diet to be having. So, and I know that you and I share similar opinions on that as well.
Absolutely. Well, I just want to let everybody know, too, that I do have gluten sensitivity, and I was tested, and it was through the good fortune of someone similar to yourself who has the ideas around, there are ideas around functional medicine as far as approaching health and diet and lifestyle issues. And that was really how I found, you know, people ask me all the time, how did you find out that you were gluten sensitive? And I'm not just gluten sensitive. I have a sensitivity to casein, to eggs, to the cruciferous family and the cashew family. And I found this out because someone believed me. And you know, that's why I love what you do, because you believe people when they come in and they say that something's wrong. You look at all of their symptoms and you take a huge, you know, you're like, let me take the eagle eye approach and how can I piece all of these things together to make sense? Like, where is, I love Mark Hyman's analogy of you walk into the kitchen and it's flooded and the first thing most people do is grab a mop. And instead, the idea is like, well, is the sink running and overflowing? So maybe we should shut the sink off and unplug the drain. And that's really what my experience had been, because prior to finding out that I was gluten-free, I had constant diarrhea, gas, bloating that was horrible. And I had colds about every 6 weeks. Anything anybody had, I ended up with. And one of the most significant issues personally was that I suffered with headaches since I was in high school. So for well over 10 years, I had had chronic headaches, and I am scared to think about how much Tylenol I took in that period of time because of how bad it was. And all of that was from gluten. And so now if I do end up accidentally eating something with gluten, I get a headache in a particular spot on my head that I know immediately that I ate something with gluten in it. So thank goodness that I had someone finally that believed me, despite all the normal blood panels that said everything was fine.
Yeah, and I mean, that's something to bring up, is that, you know, the number one site outside of digestive where gluten manifests is actually neurologic. So headaches or anxiety or depression or weakness or, you know, things like that. So just letting people know that, as they've probably know from previous podcasts with me, that you do not need to have digestive symptoms in order to be diagnosed with gluten sensitivity. So in your case, it sounds like you did. So you're probably doing some more, you know, did you get tested for celiac and some of the more common of the traditional labs?
I actually did not, because at the time back in 2008, I was told, just take more B vitamins and stop working out so much. Mm-hmm. That was literally what every doctor told me. I didn't know what celiac disease was. I didn't even know what food sensitivities were. I'd never heard of them. I come from an Italian family, so eating bread and pasta was like my birthright. Mm-hmm. So the idea that what I was eating was making me sick was never on the radar. And it was finally because I couldn't wake up in the morning, and I had so much fatigue after sleeping for 11 hours and I had felt like I was drugged. I found a nutritionist who, you know, does go to some of these functional medicine conferences and such, who was like, you know, I think your gluten, your pasta and your bread could be a problem. And she was right. So, you know, that's why I really appreciate what you do, because it digs deeper. It looks deeper. And that's why I always tell people, when you need to find a practitioner, you've got to look for someone who is going to dig deeper and not simply look at traditional blood panels that you can get at your local laboratory and go, oh yeah, you're fine, you know, you're just a little tired, because that's usually not the case.
Yeah, I always tell people that in order to have something wrong on your blood work that you get through the regular doctor at, you know, Quest or LabCorp or CPL, in order to have something wrong there, for the most part, you have to be really pretty sick. You've had to have done so much damage for it to show up there. So a lot of, you know, what practitioners like myself are checking is kind of behind the scenes before it gets to the place that it's, you know, overt, you know, damage or disease. Well, tell us about your story after you found that out. You know, what was kind of your journey after you found out that you had a gluten sensitivity? How'd your life unfold, you know, the day after that?
You know what? It was actually a blessing. The reason is that the day before I got my test results back, and I had been gluten-free for a bit of time before that because I had an adrenal stress index done, and my results suggested that something was going on, and the nutritionist said, you know, take gluten out, see how it goes. And I felt immediately better within about 3 days, just incredibly better, but I still had bouts of getting sick. And so the day before I got back my blood test results from her looking for antibodies, I had gotten so sick to my stomach that I thought I was having a heart attack and would have to rush myself to the emergency room. And, you know, I was only 28 at the time, so that's not a normal reaction to have at that age. And it turns out that I had a lot of hard-boiled eggs, and I have a very high sensitivity to eggs. So that was the last time I've ever eaten eggs, unfortunately. But that reminder of getting so sick has stuck with me and really pushed me to stay gluten-free. And what I did was I took all of my favorites and I converted them to whatever the gluten-free version was. And that's fine. You know, at first I was eating the pasta and some of the bread. The bread in 2008 wasn't too good. And not that it's much better now, but you know, I don't really eat it. However, I just transitioned over to a standard American gluten-free diet, as you mentioned. And I didn't really know that just swapping out brownies for brownies or cupcakes for cupcakes, whatever it may be, I had no idea that that was bad for you, because I thought that gluten-free inherently was healthy because I was going gluten-free for my health. And I think that's a natural assumption that many people make. And over the course of a year, I did start to get better, and then I started to get worse. It was about a 6-month progression uphill and then a slide back downhill until about 2009, almost exactly a year later, I was diagnosed with adrenal fatigue as a result of consuming all of those really starchy, gluten-free carbohydrates loaded with sugar, and my system was just really done.
Yeah, that's you know, a couple of things that you say there. I think I've also mentioned this on podcast previously as well, that I went and spoke at the local celiac chapter here, and I guess there's a potluck or something that they have, and you can bring food, and I'm standing up at the top, and you know, here I am. Yes, I'm gluten-free, but I'm also promoting a healthy lifestyle, so we're talking fruits and vegetables and green juices, and so it didn't really kind of occur to me that when I looked out at the audience and they have plates full of food, that there's 3 donuts and 2 cupcakes and, you know, rice bars and all this stuff. I mean, nobody was eating chicken salad and kale this or kale that. I mean, those things are inherently gluten-free, but it seems like a lot of people, once they get that diagnosis, they feel like, oh my gosh, I'm so deprived. And so they almost stock up on, I need to eat, you know, 2 cookies instead of 1 because it's a gluten-free one and it's not as bad for me, or I've been deprived, I have this gluten sensitivity. And, you know, we kind of rationalize this stuff. So yeah, I completely understand. I mean, now for some people, that's what they need to do, right? I mean, we have little kids come into our clinic and they have diagnosis of, you know, eczema or rash or, you know, terrible ADD, and they have to go gluten and dairy free. And they maybe were, you know, sustaining themselves on a cheese pizza or mac and cheese, and it never really was part of their diet to eat grilled chicken and, you know, a side of broccoli. So, you know, we got to transition them like you did into the gluten-free, dairy-free pasta and, you know, pizza, and then transition over to the more healthy foods. But I agree with you. A lot of people sort of get stuck at that point where it sounds like you did in the beginning as well, with just kind of a lot of the gluten-free products.
Well, and I think too, and this is what I've seen more and more as I go to a lot of different product expos. So like there's Natural Products Expo East and Products Expo West, and they're 2 different times during the year. And going to those, gluten-free is the rage. Every company now is coming out with gluten-free lines of whatever their original quote-unquote normal food options are. And unfortunately, you have people that are touting a lot of health claims, a lot of, you know, like even Char, for example. Char loves to promote the healthiness of a gluten-free diet, and yet their products are some of the worst out there because they're corn. Their base is corn, which right there, I mean, I have a problem with corn, and I know how you feel about corn. But there's just so many problems. There's so much starch, and everyone wants to be in this industry of helping everybody get healthier while they feed you junk.
Right. What company is that?
Char. S-C-H-A-R.
I don't eat a lot of gluten-free products, so I don't even know that company. So,
They're one of the largest ones throughout the world. They're from Italy, but unfortunately, you know, this isn't just them. It's so many different companies. It is not to say that all product companies are bad. There are many product companies that genuinely do care about their consumers' health, and they are more health focused. But the majority of companies, if you open up like Living Without Magazine, for example, most of the companies in there are putting tons of additives, lots of sugar, the absolute wrong type of fats that you should be eating, and everything. I mean, we just found out, 2 weeks ago, there was a study that came out saying that, yes, you can have genetic mutations as a result of consuming rice that has arsenic in it. And rice is one of the main starches of a gluten-free diet.
Yeah, rice and as you mentioned, corn. So I think, you know, it's really important when you're switching to these products, you know, corn is most all of it is genetically modified. So, I mean, I find at the few times that I do want to indulge in something, sort of finding that product that, okay, so it's gluten-free, but then what is the other grain that is in there? And if it's corn, for example, you know, is it non-genetically modified? So when you're kind of trying to find all the criteria that might potentially suit your needs of, you know, none of this type of oil and no kind of natural flavors or colors and no GMO and gluten-free, unless you're getting something that you know is locally made, it's kind of difficult to find that out there. As you were noting, and as you said, a lot of these, in order to make up the bulk of, you know, wheat flour is bulkier than rice flour. It's much more refined, which A, in and of itself, is a blood sugar issue because it's more refined, but also isn't as dense. So they typically add, as you mentioned, a lot more sugar to these products than their regular counterpart. I saw this one, I don't watch Dr. Oz frequently, but I happened to see this Dr. Oz, and they were actually comparing, you know, a standard waffle, frozen waffle, to a gluten-free frozen waffle, and a standard, you know, muffin to a gluten-free muffin. And a lot of times, in almost every case, the gluten-free one had far more sugars in them than their glutened counterpart.
Yeah. And I think that, too, we have to realize that the gluten-free industry is a $4+ billion industry currently. By about 2017, they estimate that it'll be over $6 billion. So, unfortunately, the bad aspects of consumerism have reared its ugly head in the gluten-free market, and people are just seeing dollar signs. So everyone is in a rush to get the cheapest possible gluten-free products out there to the market, to consumers, to try and be the number one product that's out there. And it's funny, I have a talk that I give that I like to tell people, I'm like, we're in Sugarholics Anonymous. People laugh and they chuckle, but the truth is, if you consistently fill your meals, and I'm sure you feel the same way, if you consistently fill your meals with any type of starchy, like you said, the waffles, the muffins, the bagels, even bread, I have a big issue with bread, and pizza and pasta, those are the main staples of your diet, you're in essence eating sugar mm-hmm. all the time.
Right. Well, so what are some, I mean, I think we've already chatted about them, but, you know, common pitfalls of a gluten-free diet, somebody who's just recently been diagnosed and they're, you know, been told to eat a gluten-free diet. So what are some pitfalls that you see typically?
Well, people gravitate, obviously, they just go to the gluten-free aisle. They figure that's safe, everything is marked. And now, thank goodness, on one little tiny sliver that we have the new FDA rules that are coming out that'll give more guidelines to what the gluten-free term actually means. But there are some shortcomings to it that, you know, we can talk about later if we have time. But my issue is that you can't just merely swap out one for one. We say, oh, I need to be gluten-free, and then completely forget that there is so much food out there that is inherently gluten-free. Like you said, there's kale. People could have been having kale smoothies. They could have been having anything else other than the donuts. But that's what people gravitate to because there's emotional ties to it. There are psychological issues tied to it in the sense that we are, you know, binding ourselves emotionally and psychologically to feeling happy or feeling satisfied or treating ourselves because we feel we deserve it to these foods. But also, too, there are some really serious nutritional issues around the lack of, I don't know, there's just not any good nutrition in a lot of these foods. They're very, very starchy, empty calories. And unfortunately, a lot of people go into the gluten-free diet being extremely exhausted. And so they load up on sugar, crash, and then feel they need more sugar. So they get another bagel, they get another donut, and then they crash again. And so they're constantly in this blood sugar roller coaster that keeps them feeling really stuck, and eventually the gut health suffers tremendously. You know, the liver just gets really, really taxed, and of course your poor pancreas and your cells, I mean, they can only deal with so much of these issues. And I'm sure you can speak to this. You know, you love the blood sugar issues. I've heard you talk many, many times about how that can be a really, really big issue for people that then end up developing more hormonal problems down the road.
So, so you have a, you know, gluten-free sugar cleanse. So what are you doing there to help people, you know, it, and I can tell myself, you know, when I do decide, okay, I'm going to indulge in this or that on occasion, you know, once I eat it, I want more. I mean, dark chocolate's usually the only thing that I can have that I'm like, okay, I can have three squares and then I'm cool. But if I go for the, you know, almond brownie, I want another one as soon as I'm done. So how can we get people off this sort of gerbil wheel of sugar, 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 carbs, carbs, carbs?
Well, I think one of the biggest keys is how you start your day. And any coach that I've ever talked to who coaches like a sports team, they'll say it's, you know, a lot of it is preparation, but it's how you go into the game that really will help your team be most successful. And I believe that that's the same way and with any person. So I experimented with myself and with my clients around breakfast. And I know that people will have some issues. Some people don't like to eat a lot of breakfast and other people do. But how you start your day is so important because you set up what tastes your body is going to crave for the rest of the day. So if you start with a muffin, every other meal of the day is looking for that sugar. So when you have, say, your salad for lunch and it wasn't sweet enough, you know, the dried cranberries weren't enough to curb the craving, then you're looking for where's my treat? Where's the candy? Let me have, you know, ooh, just one cookie. And it constantly spirals through the rest of the day that you're craving sugar. So by taking sugar out of breakfast, and I always suggest to clients, I'm like, no grains for breakfast. Do some type of breakfast that doesn't even look like breakfast. It could be leftovers from dinner. It could be a soup. You know, if you are going to have a smoothie, which I'm kind of okay with, you really got to make sure that your protein powder isn't loaded with sugar and you stick with very low glycemic fruits like berries and not that much and have a really good fat source in the morning. And most people have found that that is one of the easiest ways to stop the sugar cravings throughout the rest of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds like really good advice. And also just figuring out what works for your body. And as I've mentioned on previous podcasts, I mean, I can speak obviously only for myself, that I just go through phases where it is some mornings just a green juice with some, you know, fat in it or just a smoothie, to exactly what you said, leftover dinner or some, you know, grass-fed ground beef to bone broth. So really just kind of experimenting with what you feel like your body needs at that time. But I completely agree with you about the sugar. And then, you know, what's the effect of the sugar on the adrenal glands?
Well, for the adrenal glands, the sugar just burns the adrenal glands out. I mean, it's one of the many stimulating foods like caffeine. And unfortunately, chocolate, there is some stimulating, some aspect of stimulation there, because chocolate inherently is a more stimulating food. And then it's combined with sugar, and which is why I don't ever suggest that clients eat chocolate after like 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, because it also can affect your sleep. But by consuming so much sugar, it's so acidic, number one. So sugar inherently is an acidic food that causes your body to use up its stores of minerals, which are so important, or your electrolytes. And also, it's just taxing. I mean, for me, you know, many people that you're probably working with, I'm very much a type A individual. So I'm already over scheduling. I'm already overbooking myself. On top of it, I have an autoimmune condition, right? Because that inherently is what gluten sensitivity is. And I have some other things that I deal with as well. And so my body is already trying to deal and keep up with all of these things that have been running it into the ground for many, many years. On top of it, now I'm going to throw in sugar on top of it. And now I'm going to feed all of the bad bacteria and the yeast that live inside my gut and have them flourish, as opposed to the good, healthy bacteria that we need. So all of these things combined turn into a perfect storm. And that's really what led me down the path of adrenal fatigue. And by taking all of those out and undoing that with time, I was able to finally feel better without, I didn't even need any medication. I just needed to really change my life and do some things that help support it. So the sugar cleanse is, it's much stricter than a lot of the, I was, and since I know a lot of your, the people that may listen to this are really into paleo, it's a lot stricter than a paleo sugar cleanse, because I even believe from working with clients that for some people, maple syrup may trigger a sugar addiction. Huh. Honey might trigger a sugar addiction. You don't know what you're sensitive to until you take it all out and then you test. you know, be honest with yourself, test and see. And I've had clients tell me, you know what, I can't do honey. It really bothers me. I'm good with maple syrup, or I'm okay with dates, but they can't do certain ones. So you've got to figure, as you said, everybody's diet is individual. You've got to be careful, because even though it's natural sugar, that still could cause issues. And I think it's important to mention too, so that people have some sense of how much sugar they're eating, is that if you eat products, any products, you could even, like if you go and buy milk at the grocery store, you'll be shocked. Turn over whatever product you have and look for the sugar in grams on the nutrition label. And more or less, I mean, most people don't know what a gram even is, because I don't cook with grams. I mean, no, I don't have a visual sense of that. So I decided to look it up and figure out how much that was. And about every 4 grams equals 1 teaspoon of sugar.
Wow. That's a
lot. So it is. And so when you start adding things up, you're like, oh, wow, that cupcake that had, 40, I think there's a cupcake from Whole Foods that's gluten-free that has 43 grams of sugar in it. And I almost died because my mother got it for me for my birthday. And I was like, oh my, I don't know that I can eat this. That's just too much. But here's the thing. People will say, okay, that's great. I know I can figure out how many teaspoons of sugar that I'm having. But what does that mean in the grand context of things? So the American Heart Association says that the average adult is eating about 22 teaspoons of sugar a day. Of added sugar, okay? So when it comes to women, they advise that women should stay below 6 teaspoons of added sugar a day, and men should stay below 8 teaspoons of added sugar. Well, I mean, when you think about it and you start doing the math, like if you have 1 cup of orange juice, it's about 21 to 22 teaspoons of, grams of sugar. So you're about 5.5 right there. It adds up quickly, a lot quicker than we think it does. And so what I would challenge your listeners to do is to go and look at everything that they eat that has a label on it, where the grams and the nutritional information is present, and track how much sugar they're eating over the course of 3 days. And not to necessarily worry about fruit. I mean, fruit does have sugar, and I don't give people a free pass on fruit, because I think we tend to overeat fruit when we're trying to get healthier. But I think it's a really useful tool to kind of understand how much sugar we eat and how much our palate has been adjusted to seek out the sweeter tastes as opposed to the savory.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, I wanted to back up just a little bit of something that you said and wanted to get a little more clarity when you said you have gluten sensitivity and then you're calling that an autoimmune disease. Could you explain that?
Well, from what I've understood of reading a lot of different things and listening to a lot of different people teach on what they're really known for, is that anytime when gluten, when you are sensitive to gluten, if you have a sensitivity to something, that really is the beginning of an autoimmune situation happening in your body. I actually have an autoimmune condition that goes beyond just having a lot of food sensitivities. That's not quite common, and may have been related to all of these food sensitivities. I'm not entirely sure, and it's something that I'm just slowly starting to unfold, but it is something that your body is having a reaction to proteins that should be normal, but they're not. They're not nourished. I mean, I literally cannot tolerate eggs. My body goes into an extreme reaction, and it's awful. And so that's more, I guess, what I meant or intended to say.
Yeah. So, and I'm only asking because I had my meeting this morning with my writer of who's helping me write my book, and I'm being challenged with all kinds of questions that I just flow through my day with my patients and then have to answer these things. I mean, autoimmunity is actually turning on oneself, on your own tissue. So what I'm thinking that these other people are extrapolating or saying is that you have a leaky gut. When you have a leaky gut, which a leaky gut can lead to autoimmunity because then the proteins slip through like casein and gluten and the egg protein, then they stimulate your immune system, or things like gluten can look like the thyroid tissue. So then you begin to attack your thyroid. But that's also what they now believe is the gateway to cancer, and pretty much every disease is a leaky gut. So I think when someone's having a food sensitivity, that is showing that that particles of food that were not supposed, that were too large, like casein and gluten and perhaps the albumins and eggs, should be too large to get into your bloodstream. But because your gut is leaky, these proteins are allowed to slip through and into your bloodstream, and then you're creating a immune response to these foreign molecules. But the definition of autoimmunity is it's actually attacking your tissue. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that with the people out there, so that everybody with a gluten sensitivity, at least in my personal opinion, I don't know, again, if these other people that you're referring to have more knowledge than what I've just talked about. I don't want everybody to feel like out there that if they have a gluten sensitivity that they suddenly also have an autoimmune disease. All right. Well, cool. Well, I'd love to know, kind of really about your work at the Gluten Free School. I love a lot of your blogs and articles, and I definitely want to get into some of them because, you're really great at like the hidden sources of gluten. And I remember you had one on grilling and cross-contamination with the grill. And I know that's kind of the stuff people really like too, because it's, so eye-opening. They might be doing something and thinking it's gluten-free and then hear one of these podcasts and realize, oh, that was the final piece that they were kind of missing to get gluten-free, or to resolve that final bit of their health issues. So tell us kind of what you're doing at Gluten-Free School.
The idea behind Gluten-Free School was really to educate people on health concerns that are just as applicable to the regular population and maybe even more applicable to those that are gluten-free. So one of the latest issues that I've been tackling is hormonal issues, and just sharing with people from my own experience and bringing in experts to comment and share their experience as well is what is happening that is not being expressed or explained or discussed within the mainstream gluten-free media. So you're not going to see it in a gluten-free magazine. You're not going to see it on a blog that's posting all about food products, or that things that are not, they're just not sexy enough per se, but they're still so important to those of us who still don't feel well. And there's a lot of, especially women, there are a lot of women, and that's mostly whom I work with, who really need some support around how do you get your energy levels back? How do you start feeling better? How do you make sense of all of the confusion that's out there? And especially as we were saying on the web, there's a lot of misinformation about how to actually be gluten-free. And I was thinking earlier, how a lot of people don't realize that gluten is actually not, we say, oh, it's a protein. But people don't realize that as far as cooking is concerned, you can't really cook away gluten unless the heating source is somewhere above 500 to 600 degrees. And you're allowing that heating source to get the, grill or the pan or the oil hot enough for over 20 minutes that it can then denature gluten as a protein. But otherwise, gluten is a very stable protein. So you can't cook, your husband's regular wheat breaded chicken cutlets and then throw yours in afterwards and figure it's fine because, it was hot and it'll somehow cook the gluten off. It's not how it works. It's all of these little tidbits. That's where the idea of the grilling guide came from, was how can I share with people all the different ways that gluten can end up getting stuck into little spots in the grill, on their hands, maybe on the utensils, whatever spots people might not think about, and sharing that with them to give them more awareness to be safe. Because I think a lot of times, even though people still, they'll get glutened continually, they don't realize it, and they start to think, well, where else could this be coming in? But it's not the most obvious spots that they actually need to think of, which could be their hands. And one example of which is, and I know you're an animal lover, as am I, is animal food. A lot of pet food is made with gluten products, or they have corn in them, which I've found a lot of people to also be sensitive to as well. And you know, you forget you're touching the bag, you're touching their bowls, you're touching their food, and you don't wash your hands. And you wipe your hands all over your clothes or all over maybe your dish rag that's in the kitchen that you might be using to dry your dishes. You just don't think about it, and you end up contaminating yourself as a result. So, you know, all these different ways. And I don't know, have you ever, did you ever buy gluten-free or grain-free food specifically for any of your pets?
Yeah, that's why I was just sort of laughing, because people would joke and say, oh, well, is your dog gluten-free as well? I'm like, actually, she is. So she, for many years, was on a grain-free diet, but still a dried food. And then in the last couple of years of her life, I actually switched her over to a raw food diet. So since she actually went gluten-free before I did, which was helpful. But yeah, so I wouldn't have even that, you know, see, I just learned something. I wouldn't have, because, you know, in my life, I had already done that. So that wasn't a problem I ran across. But that's good to know for my patients, you know, yeah. If, just thinking of that.
And I also, some people have gotten on me because I've posted it on Facebook and I said, you know, you really should consider buying gluten or grain-free food. And they'll say, oh, you're being melodramatic. That's not important. It's you're making a bigger deal. And I would like to counter with one thing. Okay, maybe for me, I'm protecting myself against gluten. But let's think about the animals for a second. I mean, I don't know any dog or cat that's going to climb up a corn stalk or the top of wheat and start eating the tops of things or, a corn. You know, it's so silly and mind-boggling to me that we're feeding food to animals that we love that is not good for them. So I see it as a win-win to feed your animals in a way that also mirrors the lifestyle that you're trying to uphold. And it's also safer for you. So I look at that way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's actually, you know, kind of, you know, dogs and the wolf. So I'm thinking, wait, you know, it made more sense to me that my animal would be eating like a raw diet, you know, given its evolution. And so then I was like, oh yeah, well that makes sense that a human would probably be eating a paleo diet. I completely agree with you. I mean, it's sort of, to me, it is, you know, whatever you do for you should filter down to the children, the other family members, the dogs. I mean, the reality is that, you know, potentially people can't afford to do all that. I mean, it does get very expensive, particularly when you, if you have several children and several animals. So absolutely, if that is something that people can afford to do, it would be wonderful if, you know, if you can convert the diet of everybody. I mean, I definitely feel that, I mean, I don't know if you know, but Bella passed away recently. Unexpectedly.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, thank you. But I really feel like, you know, she would have, I do feel like her going to a raw diet really helped her in the end, you know, the last couple of years of her life, staying longer. I mean, she was nearly 14 and she was a medium to large dog. So apparently, I guess that's older than most. So what are some other kind of, you know, big hitters that you see in terms of cross-contamination or areas that people don't think of?
Well, dental hygiene is another big spot. I know that a lot of people like to, you know, everybody likes a clean mouth. We all want to have a beautiful smile and we want to keep our teeth. I think that's a really important thing. And, you know, I know for sure that not all toothpaste is gluten-free and that people don't check their toothpaste. They're not, you know, one of the first things I tell people is like, get rid of your toothbrush, get a new toothbrush, make sure that your toothpaste is gluten-free. I would tell you absolutely to try and get the most natural quality toothpaste out there. I think there's too many chemicals in a lot of the standard ones. But you also have to check your floss and your mouthwash as well, because you're putting that in your mouth. And depending on how sensitive you are, that can cause problems. And I do know people who they had cleaned out their house and never thought to check their floss, and that's where it was coming from. And they were actually getting quite sick because they're very sensitive to gluten. They just, that never would have occurred to them.
Well, so speaking of mouths, what about your partner, husband, wife, whatever, kissing?
Absolutely.
Do you see that being a problem for
and
people?
And that's a huge problem. So my husband is not gluten-free. He, in our house, eats gluten-free. But if we go out, he can eat whatever he wants without, you know, any repercussions on my end. However, he knows that if he has a beer or he has a hamburger, whatever he's going to eat, if that's the case, you know, we're not we're not kissing, we're not doing anything that's going to be potentially causing me to get gluten anywhere near my mouth. So, you know, it's just, it's an agreement that we have, and he knows that going in. And I think that that's a tricky point for a lot of people who are dating, because how do you explain that to someone? Like, now you barely know this person and they've got to accommodate your diet to that degree. But when you think about it, if you were allergic to peanuts, and you went to it, you wouldn't probably go to a Thai restaurant potentially. I mean, I don't know, but like, you couldn't kiss the person if they had some sort of peanut dish. So it's the same thing. You really have to treat your, I believe you have to treat your sensitivity just as seriously as you would like a food allergy. And, you know, not necessarily make it out that you're going to die if, you know, that person kisses you, but just explain to them that you are going to get really sick and there are some serious health repercussions to it, and you'd appreciate if they could respect that.
And so what do you do? I mean, brushing the teeth and flossing, not enough? How long do they need to wait before? I mean, obviously it depends on everybody's sensitivity of what they can tolerate. And there are probably plenty of people out there going, well, my husband or my wife, you know, isn't gluten-free and I'm just fine. But maybe somebody's learning right now that that is a potential you know, problem for them.
Yeah, I don't know how long. I honestly am not sure. For me, safety-wise, I feel comfortable saying, you know what, let's just wait until the next day. You've got to brush a couple times and really, because the truth is, I mean, I don't believe that any person just brushing once is going to get all of the stuck bread out of their teeth and out of their mouth. I just don't. I know how my body reacts as a result of gluten, so I'm being more careful than others, but it has served me well. So, you know, I would suggest, you know, really waiting, maybe doing a couple brushings before you know, and you've got to decide how safe you feel. And you got to make sure that your partner's dental stuff is also gluten-free, because like Listerine mouthwash is not gluten-free.
Well, let's hope nobody's using Listerine out there anyway.
Seriously.
So it's full of alcohol that the studies show damage and kill your cells more than they do help them. So let's hope people aren't doing that anyway. But that's good to know. I mean, some of these things I think my natural or hygiene came before my gluten. You know, that was something I grew up, I mean, my parents were sort of hippies, so I grew up getting, even though now I know Kiss My Face body products are not the cleanest ones out there, but that's kind of what I grew up on. Rather than Dial soap and things like that, we went to the health food store for our body products. So for me, Listerine's never been in my life, so I wouldn't have even occurred to me to look at Listerine. But for other people out there, you know, that are kind of doing a lot of mainstream stuff, it really is in everything. So I'm learning some hidden sources here, mostly because they're not things that, you know, have ever entered my life, so it wouldn't occur to me to look at that. So any other kind of big ones that you can think of? These are good.
I actually have another one that it shocked me. I had my assistant going through laundry detergents, and it got this whole argument sparked on Facebook, and some people were upset that I even brought it up about detergents. And there are some detergents that the companies are aware and they're gluten-free, and I do have a whole list of them, and we're still in the process of going through and figuring this out. But I had contacted a company, and I was shocked because they have gluten in their feminine hygiene products as well as their children's diapers. And it's one of those really green, I'm trying to think which company it is now because I wasn't even thinking of this earlier. It's a seventh generation. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Seventh generation. So, you know, I was thinking to myself, I'm like, you know, if you're using those products, like say you had a child, a baby that's celiac, and you're trying to do what's best. You figure seventh generation diapers, and here you are. You have these diapers that have gluten in them.
Yeah, it gets really pretty overwhelming, right?
So it does.
It's kind of back to that, what I was saying. If you want to go get a gluten-free product, a cookie or a cracker, you know, the things that you have to think about are, you know, is it gluten-free? If so, then, you know, what grain is it made with? And then is that, you know, organic and not GMO? And does it not? And now here we are. My God, I mean, what is gluten even doing in a diaper or a feminine product?
I think they're trying to use it as part of the absorption system. But, you know, when I think about that, I'm like, okay, your skin's going to be damp, which is probably not good. And that's going to cause, I mean, because I know there's a lot of people that have this question about what happens with gluten as far as touching your skin. Like, I can hold wheat and I have no problem. But if I shampoo my head with shampoo that has like hydrolyzed wheat protein in it, for example, it doesn't matter if it's organic, non-GMO, but if it has wheat in the shampoo, my whole scalp breaks out in this really funky, gross, scaly mess. And so it was just by trial and error, I figured this out. I for some reason, way back when, didn't even think to look at my shampoos and conditioners. But, you know, there are people that are sensitive enough that they do have skin reactions. And here's the other thing, because I saw that people had asked about, you know, skin. Here's my big problem with skincare products is that you get out of the shower, and you go and you slather on your body care lotion or whatever it may be, your hand lotion, and you know, you feel so great. And then you go into the kitchen and you're like, oh, I have to get ready for work. I'm going to make myself a salad. And you didn't check to make sure that your, you know, body care lotion is gluten-free. And maybe it's not because it has wheat germ oil in it, which is where the vitamin E source is, because vitamin E is all the rage in body care products. And so you go and start making your salad. So you're making a salad and you're cutting everything up and you're throwing everything in the bowl and you just didn't wash your hands because you just got out of the shower. Who would think to do that? Well, you just glutened your whole meal. And so I think this is my concern, is how does gluten from all these products end up on your hands when you then go touch food and that food ends up in your mouth? So I think that these are the things that people don't realize, don't consider. You know, you can't go and make your husband a sandwich with his regular bread and then go and make your own sandwich that's gluten-free and not wash your hands and not wash the cutting board and the knife and everything. You can't double dip with jars. There are so many things that people don't realize they can't do, and it's the sloppiness that tends to get them stuck in these predicaments where they're constantly getting glutened.
Well, you're bringing up really quite an interesting point, because I had never really thought of it. I mean, when I think of body products, I mean, there is a lot of debate about that. Can it really be absorbed through your skin? And then I hear stories about exactly what you're saying. So is that a local reaction on the skin, or does that become a more systemic reaction? And the theory is that your pores open in a hot shower and they're open and it can then get into your skin. I personally, I mean, I take my own body products everywhere I go. When I go get a massage or go to even a hotel, I take my own stuff. I don't use what they have. But when I do go get my hair cut, I don't bring my own shampoo. I mean, when I go get my nails done, I bring my own non-toxic nail stuff. But I just figure, you know, a few times a year, I don't. And I personally, I get it kind of itchy, all kind of a mild itchiness, but I don't get any kind of rash or anything like that. I haven't taken it to that extreme. But I definitely, you know, 99.99% of the other time, I am absolutely sure that I'm not getting gluten in my products. And we definitely have patients just like you that was the final, you know, as we're coming back and we're really searching for, they tell me they've definitely been gluten-free. They're eating paleo, you know, they're just the whole gamut. They're single. They have no one else in the household. They've changed out their toaster, blah, 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 blah. I guess if you're paleo like me, you don't even own a toaster. But so they've done all these things and we can't find what it is. And then I'll talk about their body products. They'll go home, they'll find it, they'll get rid of it, and whatever resolves. So all I can say is anecdotally from my patients, I have definitely had patients who have gotten better, and that's been the missing link. Sounds like to you, now I didn't think about them doing what you were suggesting, which is that they did not wash their hands, and maybe they're actually physically ingesting it rather than it just being slathered on their skin. I mean, I just hadn't thought of that as being a mechanism. So interesting.
I mean, it's just my thought that I don't want to take any chances.
Of course.
Because if you are that sensitive and you don't want your immune system to get elevated, then it's like, well, why would I put it on my hands? I mean, it's drying on my hands. I don't I don't know where else it would go. Things rub off, you know that when, like, you have oils on your hands, they rub off on your clothes. So, you know, I can't say for sure with scientific proof that that's the series of what happens, but it's one thing that I do suggest to people, to just really have more awareness around how they prepare food. And you know what? Just take it out. Get rid of any chance encounters, because at the end of the day, if your levels, you know, I know people keep getting tested and they're trying to find out, like, where is it coming? Just get rid of it all. It's just an easier way to go. You know, there's plenty of oils out there that are awesome to use for the skin, like sesame seed oil, jojoba oil.
Coconut.
There's so many great other things that are completely natural and have no gluten in them. And that's what I suggest that people gravitate to.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate that. Well, are there any kind of, before we wrap up, you know, also in terms of hidden ingredients or names that gluten can be hidden, you know, I mean, I know that there are a lot, but just ones that kind of jump out that people might be surprised at, kind of names gluten's hidden under that you can...
You know, it's hard because that's a hard question, because there's so many that, you know, we could say like natural flavors and maltodextrin, but the ingredients, depending on where they're made, will vary. And so that's one of the people will say, well, I read that gluten, natural flavors could have gluten in it. But from what I have read in the United States, if the product is made, and this is the problem. If the product is made in the United States and they're using natural flavors that are made in the United States, and they shouldn't be gluten-free, or they should be gluten-free, I'm sorry. But if it's made in, say, China, how do you know what natural flavors was made from? So you have to know, that's why I always tell people, I'm like, go back to the company and ask, because they know where they source their ingredients from. They know, they've got to know that information. It's better to just do without with a questionable product that contains a lot of these wacky ingredients that you can't spell or pronounce yourself on your own without actually looking at it. It's just not a good idea. So I would always suggest to people to go back and talk to the company and question them on, you know, where did their ingredients come from, because they've got to know the source, and that's what's most important.
And that's so true. And then things change all the time. So
right.
I even had not a debate, but somebody brought up on my Facebook page about, we were talking about thyroid and Armor, and she said, well, you know, can I still have Armor because there's gluten in it? And will that trace amount still hurt me? And I was like, gluten and Armor? Wait a minute, what are you talking about? I take Armor, I give most of my patients Armor. There's no gluten in Armor. So I'm Googling it. And apparently, you know, in one, you know, one series years ago there was, now there's not, but there's dextrin. So I, you know, called the company myself, and no, it is not wheat dextrin that is in Armor. But then it then led me down the path to Westerthroid. And they have something called Westerthroid or WP that has literally nothing in it other than the thyroid hormone. So, you know, but unfortunately, things like that are so hard to get. I mean, we called around the city seeing where we can get it, because I was going to switch over to that for patients. And, you know, these things, they're difficult to get, or they become very expensive. So, but anyway, anybody out there with the Armor question, it maybe at one point had gluten, but it doesn't now. So the point of all that is that things are ever changing and companies are getting smart. And so you really have to, as you said, pick up the phone and call the company. Don't just trust the internet. Or, and then everybody's experience is different. I mean, one of the best places for me that I like to go is, I was having some people over one time a year or so ago, and I had just some regular vodka in my, you know, like a, just a brand name vodka. And we had a drink, and one of my friends is celiac, and she, the next day, was super sick, and she was sick from the vodka. I could tolerate the vodka perfectly fine, no problem. So then I got on the celiac website, and 50% of the people are saying, you know, they, even though the company will tell you it's technically gluten-free, or it is gluten-free, that it's all been distilled out, you'll see half the people on the website saying they react to it, and the other half saying they can tolerate it just fine. So the take-home point of all that is, you really gotta, if you want to venture out on a ledge, test it for yourself rather than taking anybody else's word for, you know, if something, if you're going to react to something or not react to something.
And actually, just to add to your point about drugs, so the new FDA rulings do not apply to medications. So that is something entirely separate. And that if you, whatever medications you are getting from a pharmacy, especially if it's something like pills, if you are celiac or if you are very sensitive to gluten, you have to remember that the pharmacy might not realize when they're counting out all the prescriptions that you need your gluten-free medication to stay gluten-free. So I have heard from other people that they figured out that they were getting gluten from the pharmacy because the pharmacy was using pill counters. They figure, oh, well, it's all, you know, the same type of medication. It might come from different companies. So you may want to mention to your pharmacy, could you please make sure to clean the pill counter that you use to, you know, give me my particular number of pills.
Wow. See, you're opening my eyes to all kinds of things. Never would have thought of that one either.
Yeah. So, and the other thing about the FDA labeling is that they can include, for example, like wheat starch in a gluten-free product, so long as the product tests under 20 parts per million. So, you know, you've really got to be, just because you see a gluten-free label, and this change will be taking place over the next year, even though you see a gluten-free label, you've really still got to look at the ingredients, especially if you don't want wheat at all.
Okay. So why don't you just tell us very quickly as our final question, what is the new FDA ruling? I think it came out last week regarding gluten-free products.
So basically, all products that are labeled gluten-free must be tested under 20 parts per million. And the problem is, it's great. It's very great. So you cannot use anything that says free from gluten or gluten-free unless the company can back up with testing that it is gluten-free and then they've had it checked. But here's the problem. The FDA doesn't have people walking around the grocery stores checking to see whose products have a gluten-free label on them. The only way that they're going to get their antennas up in the air is if too many people start complaining to them that they got sick from particular products. That is when they'll go back and check to see that the company was actually getting their products tested. There's no requirement to actually get certified gluten-free because there are three different certifying bodies in the U.S. right now. So unfortunately, so it's great. We have this agreement finally on what gluten-free means. But it doesn't mean that you're safe. It doesn't apply to your makeup. It doesn't apply to your body care products. It's only to food and supplements. And even still, you know, I was shocked in the FDA guidelines that they put out. They have this sort of like newsletter they put out with all the new rules and updates and things. They specifically said that a product could contain wheat starch just so long as it tested under 20 parts per million.
Wow. So all the more reason not to eat packaged foods and to eat, you know, real whole foods, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, if you can tolerate those, and, you know, some lean animal protein, huh?
Absolutely.
Nothing in a package. Then you don't have to worry about the
exactly.
label. Yeah. So, well, that was definitely very informative. I love it when I can do a podcast or an interview and learn something. So I definitely learned something here today. So I really appreciate it. And before we depart, can you tell people how to, and we'll put the links on the blog and whatnot, but how people can get in touch with you at Gluten Free School?
Sure. They can come to glutenfreeschool.com. I'm also on Facebook, and you can just look for Gluten Free School. And I'm on Twitter. It's G Free School. And if you'd like to send me an email, if you have any questions, you can either reach me through the contact form on my website or email me at glutenfreeschool@gmail.com.
Awesome. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I think this was really valuable to our listeners, and awesome to have you on.
Thanks so much, Dr. Myers. I really appreciate it.
All right. Talk to you soon.
To stay in touch with Dr. Myers, you can sign up for her newsletter on her website at dramyers.com or connect with her on Facebook or Twitter at amymyersmd.